Now, here is Bill Resnick with Dan Handelman.
Dan Handelman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Dan, I did a Google search on you yesterday. It came up with a lot of items. One was a Street Roots article. It had a big headline, Police Bureau Beware, Dan Handelman is watching. Dan is still watching. It's been now since 1992 when he founded the organization Cop Watch, which is a part of another organization, Peace and Justice Works, that Dan also founded. So Dan, you and other Cop Watch people, also the ACLU, a number of local lawyers, also, of course, several people of color organizations, particularly Afro-American groups, you've been challenging police conduct for as long as Cop Watch has existed and even before. And a good deal of that effort is focused on control of police violence, especially killings of people. And looking at the figures, it appears to me that lethal violence has somewhat decreased. So what's the story on frequency of police shooting? And then we can talk about why and whether Portland's experience provides lessons for other cities.
Well, one of the groups we do a lot of work with that you didn't mention is the Mental Health Association of Portland. And their analysis shows that the average number of people who die each year is 3, and it's kind of been consistently 3 throughout, even though the overall discharge of firearms has gone down. And I would also add that when the average number of shootings per year changed was around 2002, when the Portland Police Bureau started getting tasers. We went from 0 taser uses a year to 400 taser uses a year. So they were pledged to us as these things as an alternative to a lethal firearm because they wouldn't necessarily kill somebody. And instead of being something that they draw as frequently as a gun, they draw it much more frequently than they use a gun. Everybody who's ever been tasered that I know says it's the most painful thing they've ever experienced and they never want to do it again. So I don't know if it's an improvement to have more so-called less lethal violence than having the firearms being discharged. We're having the same number of people die on average per year. And at least one person and one dog that we know of have been killed by the use of a taser in Portland since the tasers were introduced.
There's no question that taser use is dangerous and kills a lot of people. You've been campaigning against taser use over the years. Has it done any good?
Our campaigning? I don't know. I think what's important is that to some extent, you know, when they first got the new weapon, they used it a lot. I think officers rely on any kind of weapon they can get their hands on that makes them not have to physically put their hands on suspects. So the taser is something where they can stand back and discharge it, and the person gets electroshock of 50,000 volts, and their muscles can't do anything. They seize up. Mm-hmm. So they can go in and arrest them. And I think that's why they over-rely on it. So there was a guy who was in charge of the crisis intervention team that's supposed to de-escalate situations when somebody has a mental health crisis, who came and spoke to a community group, and he said, well, you know, we'll talk to them for 10 or 15 minutes to try to get them to go to the hospital. If that doesn't work, we'll just taser them. And I really think that was their attitude, that when they couldn't succeed with their verbal skills, the next thing they do is use the taser.
And this is the crisis intervention group.
This is the guy.
Much less than the police.
Yeah. So I think that crisis intervention team has improved somewhat over the years, but a recent report just came out that shows that supervisors were saying, if you do what I say, I won't taser you. They said that was de-escalation. That the Portland police believe saying a threat, you know, basically that saying, if you do what I say, I won't taser you, that's a form of de-escalation. So they don't understand what de-escalation is.
Yeah. And of course, when you say that, if they don't do what they say,
then the cop is
going to do it because they can't lose face. One thing about cops is they have to have their authority respected or they get really powerfully fearful.
Right. A lot of the interactions that we hear about are the result of failure of the attitude test. The cop doesn't like the fact that you challenge their authority or that you stand up for your rights. We still encourage people to do it, but we also say, you know, you really have to judge the situation because if you assert your rights to the point where it's angering the officer, they're the ones with the gun and the badge and the taser and the power of law behind them.
And impunity, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the dilemma. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Dan Handelman of Cop Watch, which he founded in 1992.
Co-founded. No, go on.
Co-founded. Yeah, there's lots of members. It's a wonderful organization. You're a major player, though. Mm-hmm. You sit in the office every day. We've discussed the fact that whereas police shooting of weapons has gone down, other forms of violence There's probably a lot of hitting too, but at least tasering, which is all recorded, has gone way, way, way up, and police are more and more using that. And some people get killed by tasers.
Mm-hmm.
Not as many as get killed by shotguns or bullets, though.
That's true.
Since you've preceded in this struggle to stop police shootings and killings and other kinds of violence, you began this quite a while ago. Other cities, there's also been groups doing it. But it seems to me Portland has a long record. I'm wondering what you think could be done, should be done. What are the lessons at Portland that you've learned that might work and that other cities who are now struggling can use?
One of the specific things that got us started was the shooting of Nathan Thomas. He was a 12-year-old boy who got taken hostage in his home in Laurelhurst. And the police surrounded the guy and were telling him to put the knife down, put the knife down. And they thought they saw the knife move, so they opened fire, and they killed him and the 12-year-old boy. This was early 1992.
That is the assailant of Nathan Thomas, but they
correct.
Killed both of them.
They correct, yeah. Yes. So the family, unusually, didn't sue the police. Instead, they said, we want you to set up a crisis intervention team, and I'll explain more what that looks like in a minute, and we want you to set up an award for officers who de-escalate situations. So there is still, to this day, something called the Nathan Thomas Award that goes out. And, you know, the bad news is that there's also a thing called the Police Medal that they were giving out to officers who were shooting and killing people for a long time. The community pushed back, especially after the officers that killed Jose Mejia in 2001 got awards. But they just started giving them out to shooter officers again.
And well, you have to do is shoot and you get an award. That's a great incentive.
Right. It's the wrong message. It's you're joking, but that's the message that they're sending out.
Yeah, I'm
right? If you want to be recognized, shoot somebody. So the crisis intervention team, the point, it was created in Memphis, Tennessee, and they teach officers how to recognize mental health or substance-driven behaviors so that they can figure out a way to talk to a person who's not responding in a rational, I guess, for lack of a better term, in a rational way. But the idea behind the Memphis model, as they call it, is that they have to get volunteer officers who really want to do this to get this special training. And then when Jose Mejia was killed in 2001, the crisis intervention team officers went in to the mental hospital where he'd been taken by. He was taken to a mental hospital. And he broke out of his room. So the crisis intervention team went in, talked him back into the room, and then they went off duty. And he broke out of the room again. And when the officer came back, the crisis intervention team officers weren't there, and they ended up shooting and killing him. So we had been saying till that point, and we continued to say, why don't you just train all the officers in crisis intervention? That'll help de-escalate. You know, it doesn't matter if the person had a mental health crisis or not. They'll know how to de-escalate. And it wasn't until James Chastity was killed 5 years later in 2006. He was beaten down by the police in September of 2006. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary this fall. That magically they found the money to train all the police officers. And so now every officer gets 40 hours of crisis intervention training. And to the extent that force and deadly force are down, I'm hoping that part of that is because every officer now has this crisis intervention training to some extent. The other thing that we're attributing it to, though, is gentrification. That we keep saying that gentrification.
Poor people are being driven out of Portland.
There's nobody left for the police to beat up anymore.
Except that there's also a much larger population in Portland than in 1992 or even 2000. So you really have a huge increase. And you have also a huge increase in guns on the street and everywhere, in every home. I mean, what are there, 10 guns for every household in the United States, or 4 or something like that, although that's concentrated. Some have 100 and some don't have any. It seems to me the danger that cops feel, and they do feel some danger because there's guns everywhere, that you would think there'd be more shooting, but...
No, well, that's all hype. I mean, there's like 120 police officers killed every year, and maybe a third of them are killed by firearms. Most of them are killed in automobile accidents or other kinds of on-duty things.
Yeah, lumberjacks die much more. Truck drivers die
more. And construction workers,
Construction workers, I know, that's their hype. But still, they feel danger.
But that's the thing. You can't entrust people with the power to take away human life and let them go out there based on their feelings. You have to get them to recognize the true nature of what the crime rate has been. And the crime rate has gone down since the 1970s. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, enormously.
It perpetuates the problem to uphold the police when they say, I feel threatened when I'm out in the street.
Yeah. And the police training people even if the training doesn't sink in very well and these cops have personalities which they express, it does express the police department's policy of not shooting and of some opposition to violence in terms of policy. On the other hand, it seems to me really bad decisions by cops does not get punished. That's the other side of it, though. It may well be that the police have a policy and the community has a policy, but in fact, the DAs do not intervene in these things. And when it goes to arbitration and it becomes a matter of the police contract, all of them get basically, at worst, they get a slap on the hands.
Well, no, they usually get their job back and money for the time they were taken off the force.
Well, a few of them lose a little bit. Hasn't there been some who have been demoted? Temporarily, at least.
Well, that's the thing. Not after shootings, no.
No?
No. There was a guy who engaged in road rage and inappropriate touching of subordinate females, and he was going to be fired, and the chief said, oh, I'll just demote him instead. And he was back in the news this past couple of months for spraying a woman neighbor whose dog was going relieving itself in his yard with his garden hose. The same officer.
Really?
And he just seems
Why
to have
didn't
some,
he do it to the dog?
I don't know. He just seems to have some anger problems.
Yeah. Well, that's another side of it, it seems to me. Recruitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
People express themselves. There are ways of weeding out people who like to fight and who like to get into arguments and who can't deal with their anger. And I don't think the police are doing much about that.
Well, that's an interesting point. There's a police psychologist who has had the job. He lives in Lake Oswego. His claim to being diverse, he's a white guy, is that he grew up in a black neighborhood in Chicago and hid in the bathtub because the adults around him were afraid he was going to get hit by gang bullets. He's been a police psychologist since 1999. And we pushed back a lot on that. The AMA, Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, that I'm part of, went to city council and said this one white guy has been doing all the interviews with police about their psychological issues for the last, you know, however long, and look what we're getting. And he finally hired a female of color to assist him with the interviews after the pushback. But his contract is up again this fall in October. So hopefully that's something that KBOO listeners will be paying attention to and other people. And we'll see if things have gotten better.
What are the other ways can police behavior be better controlled and changed? And I think we probably could have spent a lot more time talking about police review boards and special prosecutors instead of letting the police investigate themselves, and then the DAs who rely on the police and have relationships with them make those decisions.
The only time an on-duty Portland police officer has been charged with a crime for a shooting was when an officer accidentally loaded his beanbag shotgun, so-called beanbag shotgun, with live rounds and shot somebody in the back. That person was permanently disabled. That officer was never successfully prosecuted because he committed suicide last year. And, you know, it's very sad. We don't want to see anybody die. You know, we make it clear. We want the officer to go home safe and we want the civilians to go home safe. But as a result of his suicide, there's been no prosecution of an on-duty cop in Portland's history. Not for a shooting.
Right.
But the other thing you said, police review board, we'd have two things in Portland that are, one is literally called the police review board and one's called the citizen review committee. The police review board meets behind closed doors, has a majority police members, and reviews cases once the officer's commander thinks the officer should be disciplined for whatever happened, or if there's been a finding of that there was no misconduct and somebody from internal affairs or what's called our independent police review division disagrees with that proposed finding. So that police review board meets in secret, and nobody from the public, not even the person who was harmed by the police, can go to that police review board. We have the citizen review committee, hears appeals. So if the outcome of that whole other system is that there was no misconduct, the person who got wrong can say, hey, I want a second chance at this. A panel of 11 citizens gets to listen to their appeal and make a recommendation to the chief about whether or not that was a correct finding. Right now, because we're under scrutiny from the U.S. Department of Justice for excessive force, especially against people in mental health crisis, they're trying to change that system. And instead of finding a way to speed it up, which is what the DOJ asked for, they're proposing to take the public appeal hearings by the Citizen Review Committee and push them into the Police Review Board behind closed doors. So there will no longer be any public hearings for the community to attend. And there's been a lot of pushback. The Citizen Review Committee on Wednesday night said, we demand that you do not vote on this proposal until we have time to figure out something where there can still be a public aspect. because there's no way we can do our jobs properly behind closed doors, especially in a room that's full of police. So we'll see what happens with that. Right now, the city council is planning to vote on this September 7th, and we're hoping that people will contact them and say, well, let's slow it down. We need to have a transparent process where we can be part of it.
That's September 7th.
That's right now when it's scheduled. But like I said, we're hoping that that gets delayed, but we'll continue to let listeners know about that.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KVU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm talking to Dan Handelman, founder of Cop Watch, who's been instrumental in this city in watching the police and critiquing them. Dan has been instrumental in the effort in Portland, partially successful, as he's discussed, of controlling police conduct. There's a really long way to go just in terms of the police themselves. There's another side of it, though, it seems to me, that we should talk about at least briefly. There's also sort of the social relations between police and community. As long as we have this immense inequality in the United States, lack of opportunity, really severe lack of jobs for anybody who doesn't have nice teeth and smile right and be submissive. It seems to me if that continues, then the huge battle between police and community is, and many communities are going to continue. The inequality now is growing so great in the United States, and the feeling of unfairness is even greater. It seems to me that, and the police, of course, and the mental health system is being denied money because rich people want to even be richer and richer, and so the state is being, state services are being gradually cannibalized in order to increase the bank accounts of the 1%. We have to think about those, at least the larger societal dilemmas, and the fact that the police are sort of the last line of defense of the property, and the first line of defense, in fact. And their job is to control people who are showing signs of who the police think are somehow dangerous.
Remember during the Occupy movement, particularly here in Portland, everybody said, we are the 99%, and they tried to reach out to the police officers who are not making a huge amount of money, but they're certainly not among the 1%. And so they were saying, hey, police officers, you're part of the one, you know, the 99% with us. But the police officers ended up shooting them with pepper spray and beanbag sure. guns and arresting them at the behest of the people who are wealthy, because that's their role in society. And it's unfortunate that we talk a lot about these police community relations, and police officers try to have basketball games for kids and give out food to people who are hungry. And I don't want to deny them doing that. I think that's good that they're willing to make those gestures. But I think to ignore the fact that they might the next day shoot your brother and then not be sorry for it, not be held accountable for it, and continue to shoot your other brother because nothing was done the first time. You know, you can't really play basketball with those people. Yeah. That's my point. Institutionally, you know, police community relations, I want to bring the police into the community so they understand what's going on and that they are less likely to shoot and beat up people, because the more they know people, the less likely they are to harm them.
And there's also the stop and frisk heavy policing modes that many of them are in, which antagonize people enormously.
Right.
Dan, it was really good talking to you again. Keep up the good work. I hope we'll talk again in better times.
Okay.
With the police under much more control. In fact, even having a police force that's willing to see itself in within a constitutional system rather than the front line of the property. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Dan.
Sure.
Spiritual, yes it is spiritual. No, I'm not poison. No, I'm not poison.
I am not poison. No, I am not poison. Just a boy from the hood that got my hands in the air in despair. Don't shoot, I just wanna do good. I am not poison. No, I am not poison. Just a boy from the hood that got my hands in the air in despair. Don't shoot, I just wanna do good.